Three, two. Oh, hang on. I my finger slipped.
That's what she said.
All right. Three, two. Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore. Friends, it's good to be with you again, coming to you from the Democracy Den in Oklahoma City. Listeners, I've got a good surprise for you. Guess who's here with me?
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Melson. Good to see you.
What is up, man?
Dr. Melson returns to the microphone here on Let's Pod This.
It has been a minute.
It has been a minute.
It has been a minute.
What have you been up to?
Lots of working.
Yeah.
Lots of work. Yeah, no, that's the predominant, you know, it's a time that we recorded every week, and it was time that I was able to spend doing that, and it has been for the last year and a half or so that time has disappeared. Work is good. It's busy, but it's been, you know, that's the my lack of being here is not a lack of desire. It's a lack of us being able to align our schedules.
Yeah. That's the dark side of a promotion, right? Is that you have less time for yourself.
Something like that.
For democracy. You know, that is the way it goes. Well, it's good to have you back. And you're back because this is episode 300.
That is wild.
Holy bananas.
That is wild.
We started this podcast in 2017 in the before times. Life was very different for everybody.
I mean, in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. If you had said in 2017 that we would be doing our 300th episode in 2025 and Donald Trump would still be president, I would have said, what does that country look like?
And it's probably exactly what we would have guessed.
Yeah.
I mean, by the middle or whenever, the early 2017, when we started this, he had been in office. Oh, no, just for a few months.
Yeah.
We would not have guessed this.
No.
Would you have guessed that we were on the brink of war in the Middle East yet again?
It wouldn't have surprised me. I probably wouldn't have. I mean, it wouldn't have surprised me. I don't know that I would have laid that out there as a marker, but it's not shocking. I mean, I did see an interesting kind of montage that CNN put together yesterday. And it starts in either 94 or 96. Mm-hmm. And it is a series of clips of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, yes.
Talking about
with slides.
Yeah, with slides. And it's like, it's a series of clips of Benjamin Netanyahu talking to the UN, congressional hearings, joint sessions of Congress, interviews. And in each one, he has like a different thing showing that Iran is merely weeks away from just weeks away from the capability of producing a nuclear weapon. Yeah. And it's like, so they've been weeks away for 20 years. Yeah. Right. And like,
it sounds like me with some of my home projects. Like, I mean, I'm weeks away from finishing it for 20 years.
I mean, right. And you know, like, we don't, like, this is not a foreign policy podcast. Like, we don't have to get too into it, but like, it is just, you know, it is, I mean, I'm sure, you know, the Iranian, they probably do want a bomb, right? But like, it's just fascinating to me. Like, we're in this situation now where you've got Trump is saying, you know, well, in 2 weeks we're going to decide like if we're going to bomb Iran, and then that's a question like, okay, well, if we bomb Iran, are we at war with Iran? I don't think so, because,
well,
he can unilaterally.
Are we at war is a whole other question.
I mean, this is the thing, right?
We haven't actually technically
declared war on anyone since Korea, right?
No, World War II.
World War II, so Korea wasn't even
official. Those are all military actions.
Right.
Or just presidential, whatever his edict is.
Well, because the thing is, like, this matters because so much of what he's wanted to do in terms of immigration is predicated on using emergency powers that are relegated to presidents to use in wartime.
Right.
But I think there has to be a congressional declaration of war, right?
Oh, right. Which, again, we haven't had since World War II.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though, because, I mean, a lot of what he's tried to do is, like, involving the Insurrection Act. And,
yeah.
And it's like, he hasn't quite had cover to do that. And so he's like, well, what if we could declare war? Then I could do more of the bad stuff I want
to
do.
Right, but then that brings the question is, I do not know the answer to this. I've never looked it up. what percentage of Congress has to vote to make a declaration of war? Because you would think it is not a simple majority.
That's a good question. I'm going to Google it while we're talking.
Right.
Do you want to adjust your microphone?
Yes.
Yeah, the more you can talk directly into it, the better.
Talk directly into you.
There we go. Well, so I just quickly Googled, and it is a simple majority in both the House and the Senate.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. While there have been 11 formal declarations of war in U.S. history, which is not many given the 250 years, but the last one was World War II. We were right. Look at us go, Scott.
So in theory, then, that's terrifying. So the Republican Congress could unilaterally declare war so that Donald Trump could use wartime powers.
Yeah, but remember, several members of Congress of his party have, like, defected on this issue, including, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, but do any of them have the stones to, like, hold up to him for the long term?
I don't know what they're capable of, Scott. They do weird things right all the time.
I mean, it is...
They're eating the dogs.
Right? It's just, you know, it's just wild. Like, because he gave himself this two-week deadline, and, like, is he actually going to do anything in 2 weeks? Because he has a history of saying, mm-hmm. we're going to do stuff in 2 weeks.
Right.
And then the other thing is, you know, it's like, I don't know who, because on the one hand, I want to be like, dude, your director of national intelligence says that, like, they don't have a bomb, and, like, this is like a non thing, and that they're not even close. But then I'm like, also though, you're DNI is Tulsi Gabbard, and Trump's like, yeah, I don't care what she says. Right. I'm not listening to my director of national intelligence. It's like, well, are you a moron? It's like, or well, are you smart? Because I wouldn't listen to Tulsi Gabbard.
Right. Like, I mean, he didn't appoint these people because he actually wants their input.
Right. Right.
Right. He appoints them for favors, for money. Like, this is it's a whole different paradigm.
Right.
Yeah. These are things we wouldn't have thought of in, like, February of 2017.
Right. I mean, it's just, And I mean, I don't think it's shocking that these are the things he wants to do. It is still, it shouldn't be after, I mean, I guess it's not now. It would have been shocking to me in February of 17, right? After what we've seen for the last 8 years, it's not. In February of 17, I would have been shocked that what remains of the Republican establishment allowed him to do this.
Oh, yeah.
That would have shocked. Like, the fact that Donald Trump would have wanted to use the presidency as a, like, grift machine, mm-hmm. To enrich himself and his family, like, that doesn't shock me at all. In February of 2017, it would have shocked me that the Republican establishment would allow it. That doesn't shock me at all.
Because he was so unpopular
when
he was running, right? Yeah. And, like, it just was outlandish. And I think we would have assumed that by the end of his first term,
well, I mean,
his party would have become unpopular, much the way that we see it's happened here with, like, Governor Stitt or Governor Fallon before him. Like, over your tenure, you tend to make a lot of unpopular decisions or at least be ineffective.
Yeah.
And people might be like, okay, we're done with this guy.
100%. 100%. And so, yeah, it is just, and it's just, you know, we were kind of thinking about, like, what are we going to talk about today? Like, where do we take this ship?
Yeah.
And you said, you know, kind of just reflections on, like, where we are as a country.
Yeah.
I've thought a lot about that, actually. I've thought a lot about that. And I think, you know, and this kind of ties into, obviously, what we are all about here. Let's fix this. You know, what we are seeing is we are seeing the consequences of decades of not investing in education generally, but civic education specifically, mm-hmm. right? We're seeing the consequences of decades of allowing money in politics, right? Mm-hmm. To the extent that we do, right? We're seeing the consequences of Citizens United. We're seeing the consequences of the lack of meaningful campaign finance reform. You know, we're seeing the consequences of just this, you know, complete, because of all of these things, I think because of the way we haven't, you know, taken educating our citizenry seriously, because of the way we've allowed just blatant corruption to take hold. And then you combine that with the internet, we're seeing we've had a complete erosion of trust in all of our institutions.
Yeah.
I saw a patient this week that has an advanced cancer And they are seeing a oncologist and, you know, on chemotherapy and these things. They're also buying ivermectin from Tractor Supply.
Right.
And taking that, you know, because they asked their oncologist and they're like, I mean, I don't think it's going to hurt you. So they're literally buying ivermectin, like horse ivermectin, right? Mm-hmm. And using it. And I just, and this is a patient that I met with their spouse. And I asked them, I was like, can I just ask you like a couple of questions? They're like, sure. And I was like, where did you hear to do that? Mm-hmm. Like, where did that come from? And they're like, Joe Rogan. And then they said somebody else. And I said, okay, all right. And I said, can I ask you another question? I said, why do you trust Joe Rogan and not your doctor? Mm-hmm. Right?
A valid question.
Right? And to be fair, they are taking like the chemo and doing the things like that their doctors tell them to do.
They're just treating the ivermectin like a supplement.
Right. And
St. John's wort and ivermectin.
And all of it came down to trust. Like all of it came down to I don't feel like I can trust any institution, right? And my doctor represents the institution of medicine, and I can't trust that. I can't trust the institution of medicine because they told us, and it was literally like because they told us to wear masks in COVID, and then they said masks don't work. And it's like, right, but like, and this gets to like, okay, but we now we're talking about you have a fundamental lack of understanding of like science, mm-hmm. right? And like how science works and the kinds of questions that science not only is designed to answer, but how it answers those questions, right? And so we've just, anyway, I'm like rambling now, but it's really like that, to me, that's where we are as a country.
Like erosion of trust?
Erosion of trust because of all of these other things, right? And we haven't even talked, I mean, like, you know, people like, what are you like most worried about for us as a country? You know, I mean, certainly there's very valid concerns about, you know, the state of our democracy and what that will look like and how it will survive or if it will survive. That's a great question. You know, culturally, what does it look like in 10 years after this, you know, massive, you know, immigration, you know, push? Like, what's that? Mm-hmm. What's that doing to the fabric of the country and the trust of people to their fellow citizens? What does that do? But I mean, honestly, I mean, and it gets real technical, and I don't have like all of the relevant expertise. I mean, I don't have any of the relevant expertise. Mm-hmm. I am real worried about our financial situation as a country.
Right? Yeah. The debt and the deficit are both out of control, and if this,
and I'm a Democrat,
right, 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 and if this big ugly bill passes, it's going to skyrocket, and the U.S. will be on the precipice of default in a few different ways.
Right, I mean, like because you know, people we've said for years that deficits don't matter. I mean, not we, but like people, you know, leaders in both parties.
People who want to spend a lot of money.
Yeah. The Democrats say that deficits don't matter most of the time. Republicans say that Democrats don't matter as long as, or Republicans say that deficits don't matter as long as they're the ones in power.
Right.
And the thing is, there's actually, economically, there's truth to that when you have historically low inflation and historically low interest rates.
And a very strong U.S. dollar that is the world standard.
Right, right. But all of that is now in jeopardy. Some of it because of factors that are, you know, extraneous. COVID, the results of inflation, and that's never really kind mm-hmm. of, you know, we never really recovered from that, right? But some of it is a lot of it is very, very much self-inflicted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it looks like they're about to pass this bill that by all accounts is going to, you know, increase the debt by trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And we will be soon at current interest rates at a point where the servicing the national debt will be the largest point of our budget.
Right. So to frame this differently, this is a little more palatable to most of us, right? It's like if you just put more and more stuff on your credit card, and then your monthly payment goes up, and at some point, you're paying most of your paycheck every month is going to pay your credit card payment, not actually pay down the principal, just make the minimum payments.
Yep, yep.
And we all know that if you only make the minimum payments on your credit card, you will never pay it off.
And that's where we're headed as a country. Like, that's the direction we're going in as a country, right? And the thing that's funny about this is, and I've said it here on the show, I've said it to you, you know, people say, people, legislative leaders at all levels say all the time, well, we can't do this financially. We can't do that financially. I mean, would you do that with your household budget?
Right.
You know, the government, we can't spend money. You know, we can't spend money that we don't have. You can't do that at home. I can't do that at home. And my retort to that is always, okay, well, let's talk about how you run your household budget compared to the U.S. So for which country is your household the universal currency?
Right.
for whom do you provide national defense?
Well, I'm my household.
Right. I mean,
but
like
also, this, do you spend half of your money on paying your credit card?
No, but that's the point I'm making is like, we're actually at like, now we're at a point where I think that the situation is so bad that to some degree that comparison becomes apropos for the first time. Right.
Oh, right.
It is like, it's absurd. Like it has always been absurd for people of both parties to say we have to run the government's finances similar to how the median American family runs theirs.
Right.
That's it. Like that, like you shouldn't even have to engage with that argument. It's it's such a straw man, but at a very, very, very macro level, right? If the most of your spending is servicing your debt, you are in trouble, whether you're an individual, a family, a company, or a country.
Right. Right. No, this is exactly what gets like oil and gas companies in trouble, right? In the boom and bust cycle where they take on a bunch of debt to expand, to drill or whatever. And then if suddenly the price of oil collapses, then they have all this debt they have to pay with not enough revenue. And then they go under, right? And this has driven the economy of our state for 100 years.
I mean, at some point, like I think in the next, now, maybe this is all wrong. I don't think it is. I haven't done the math because, as I said, I don't have the relevant expertise, but I've been reading and listening to a lot of people who have the relevant expertise. And like, if this goes how it appears it's going to go, then in like 10 years, we're going to be in a real nasty situation where the options are going to be either one, drastically cut spending. And I don't just mean on, you know, Air America, right? Like the you know, $10 million or whatever it is a year that we spend trying to broadcast messages about democracy to developing countries, right? I'm talking like we're going to have to cut spending that everybody cares about. We're going to have to cut defense. We're going to have to cut healthcare. We're going to have to cut the social safety net. They're going to have to cut Social Security. Like,
I mean, they're already talking about it.
But I mean, they're going to have to. Like it's like, and they're not talking about cutting defense, right? And and they're not really talking about cutting Medicare, right? They're talking about cutting Medicaid,
right?
And making states more responsible for it, right?
Right.
So, but like in 10 years, they're either going to have to default, drastically cut spending across the board to levels that would be, I think, incredibly painful economically, right? Or enact across the board broad-based tax increases.
Well, and Oklahoma knows something about this, right? Like in 2017, when we started this podcast, we didn't know that there would be three special sessions that year dealing with this budget crisis, which started the year before. And it did have these disastrous across-the-board cuts, right, to every state agency. And I also think what happens along the way between now and then...
And they still had to raise taxes.
Right. Is that they, the other thing that happens along the way, right, is that they don't make those big cuts. They start making little cuts and everything just starts to break, right? Like we are unable to do the maintenance on our infrastructure. Oklahomans know if you drive around, right? Like you hit potholes, our roads and like our bridges, there's a big project to like rebuild all these bridges and then we didn't keep it going. And now we've got a number of bridges that are in disrepair and it starts, I don't know how else, like feeling like a poor country, right? Yeah.
And the thing is, what's frustrating is we can afford it, right? Like we can afford to, like we are the wealthiest country in the world. We can afford to fix all of this stuff, right? But instead we are choosing to take all of that wealth and one, concentrate it in the hands of people at the very, very top, right? Two, the stuff that we do spend on it as a country, spend on it largely on guns and bombs, right? And three...
or other rockets that blow up.
Right, right. And three, you know, I mean, there probably do need to be some changes to Social Security, right? Like there probably need to be some changes to the retirement age. Like you probably need to have a conversation about, you know, do people that have made, you know, I don't know, pick the number. Like you can pick whatever number you want, you know, $500,000 or $1 million or $2 million or 10, whatever it is, right? If people that have had at some certain income threshold and have spent their career there, right, do those people need Social Security, right? Right. If you have a retirement account worth, you know, if you have a retirement account in the millions of dollars, like, do you need Social Security?
Right.
Right. Or should you get Social Security? Like, I think those are conversations that, like, we're going to have to happen. We're going to have to have. And the thing is, what frightens me is that, and now, you know, we're 5-10 years away from this probably, but someone is, we are as a country, we are going to need a leader, right? We're gonna need a leader for that. And like, who is that person, right? I mean, like, who is it? I don't, you know, I mean, you look at the left, like, I mean, maybe it's Pete Buttigieg, right? Like, maybe. You know, I don't think it's Gavin Newsom. I don't know that it's, you know, I don't know that it's Gretchen Whitmer. Shapiro. Know, I don't know that it's, I mean, maybe Andy Beshear. Maybe Andy Beshear. You know, maybe somebody that we haven't even thought of yet. But like, you know, I look at the landscape of the left that I feel like I know reasonably well and have trouble finding someone. Mm-hmm. I know one on the right. I'm not sure aware of someone, mm-hmm. right? Like, as long as the like Trump fever dream has a hold of the folks on the right, then like I don't see anyone there. Mm-mm. Right. So that is what frightens me, is like, not that that fiscal crisis is one, that the fiscal crisis I think is going to come. Two, it worries me that I see a huge vacuum at the top, mm-hmm. of how we're going to get through that as a country.
Yeah. Well, Scott, we're halfway into this podcast, and I'm just all roses and unicorns over here. And which is funny. I want to pivot a little bit away from international insecurity.
Doom and gloom.
Yeah, doom and gloom. But to a more of a reflective position, because this is where I've been this week thinking about this episode, is that I think for me and for you, at least personally, and perhaps for the whole country, or at least for our listenership, I think a notable change over the last 8 years that we've been doing this is like sadness. Like, it's exhausting. If you go back and listen to our early episodes, we were funnier. We made a lot more jokes. It was lighthearted. It was serious, but we had an ability to like talk about the Oklahoma legislature and what was happening in our state with like an earnestness, right? With like a righteous indignation about some things. But I think we were also funnier. And I know, just because we talk every day, like I know that we've seen some shit over the last few years, right? I've lost both my parents. As one thing that I definitely point to, I saw a picture of myself from 2017 the other day, and my beard was so dark. It was very, like, just a full black beard. My hair was only a touch of gray, and now it's quite the opposite.
Silver fox over here.
But it is funny, and I, you know, some of the episodes that I've done over the last couple of years, even maybe just the last year or two since you've not been on as often, the ones that I got the most response to were the ones where I talked about like our collective existential exhaustion, right? Like everyone's kind of like, oh God, I'm so tired. Like it's so hard. Why is everything so hard and so tiresome? And now with this like other, I don't know, layer of uncertainty about what the future looks like, it makes me wonder, this is my observation, or a wondering that I think you'll appreciate. You and I both enjoy British humor.
Indeed.
British humor is different than American humor.
Indeed.
Do you think British humor is somewhat a byproduct of, I mean, many more years of time, often as the, you know, we'll say the world's foremost superpower in some way. The British pound was the de facto currency for the world for a long time. And the Brits that I know, which aren't many, but I know them to be a little more measured because like they too have seen some shit and they're tired and they're just like, and so like their humor is different. And I wonder if American humor is evolving to be more like British humor.
That's a really interesting question. I've not ever given that particular question thought. I think British humor, interesting. I mean, I think British humor evolves from, you know, one, there is a much still, I think, Not as much as it was for centuries, obviously, but a much more rigid class system in the UK, right?
That's true.
And I think that's part of how their humor evolves, there's, right? Like that very much like kind of buttoned up,
yeah, reserved,
right? Like there's like posh and then there's like not, right? So I think that's part of it. I also think you have a, I think you develop a particular sense, sensibility about, you know, what you find amusing and what you don't when your whole like society is centered on an island in the North Atlantic where it, mm-hmm. rains most of the time.
Right, that's fair.
You know what I mean? So I think that probably informs it as well. But I do think that there is certainly not just the UK, but I think the world over, particularly in Europe, but also, I mean, also in Asia, China, Japan, you know, I think there's a tendency to look at the US and all of our, you know, kind of proclamations about whatever it may be as, oh, you guys are adorable, but you're just a baby.
Right.
Right. I mean, China's like, we've had literal dynasties that are longer than your country has existed.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, we'll be 250 years old next year. Right.
Right. But I do think you're right. I think there is an element of national sadness. I will also say there is an element of like, Americans, like, by and large, we're unhappy. Mm-hmm. Like, we're unhappy. If you look at the, like, global happiness indexes, right, and there's, like, a variety of them, I want to say the most recent one I looked at, we're, like, 17, 18, 19, 20, somewhere in there. Like, it's not, like, we may even be lower than that. I thought we were 17.
But I'll tell you in just a second.
But we're nowhere near the top, for sure. You know,
We are 24th.
Yeah, and who borders us on either side?
England is 23rd. Nice. Okay. And Belize is 25th.
Okay, who's a couple more on either side?
I'll just read top down. Yeah. I'll go to the top 25.
Okay.
Number 1, Finland. 2, Denmark. 3, Iceland. Sweden. Netherlands. So there's most of the Scandinavian countries. Costa Rica. Norway. Israel. That might change. Luxembourg. Yeah, they're filthy rich, and there's like 12 of them. Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, Belgium, Ireland, Lithuania, Austria, Canada, Slovenia. Chechnya is 20th. That's a country I forget about.
The Chechnians are happier than we are.
Uh-huh, but several points.
My goodness.
UAE, United Arab Emirates, is 21st.
That tracks.
Yep.
The men are very happy.
Yeah, I mean, and I've had family who lived there recently, and they're like, that's pretty nice. Germany, UK, US, and then Belize is 25th. Least happy, Congo, Iran, Gabon, Mozambique.
How many countries did they survey? Like, what are they like? Are they like 200?
Sorry. That was 100. They surveyed 147. The actual lowest is Afghanistan. They're at 147. Sierra Leone, Lebanon, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Botswana.
Yeah. I mean, like, so, you know, we're not down there with like developing countries, right? Unless you consider Belize a developing country, or Mexico or whatever, but like,
they're not.
Yeah. I wouldn't think so. Right. So we're not in that category, but we're not where I think we're not where people would maybe expect we would be. Right. And yeah, I think it's dissatisfaction with our government. I think economic mobility has stagnated in this country. And I think that a lot of the things that people living in the United States find frustrating have gotten worse in the last 8 years and not better. And so this kind of national sadness or malaise or unhappiness or however you want to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me that it has gotten worse.
I will say this has been kind of doom and gloom, but I feel, and literally just in the last couple of weeks, that at least in my circles or the things that I follow online as well, that there that unhappiness remains, but there's like the tiniest ember or spark of something, right? And this, I think often these things come together, right? Where we feel like you're approaching rock bottom. And as terrifying as that might be, some among us start thinking about what it could be, like the potential that's out there. As an example, yesterday afternoon, we had a Democracy Drinks happy hour over here at Skydance Brewing. And there was about, I don't know, 30-ish, 35 people who came. Many of them I knew, a number of them I didn't, which was exciting. Really interested to talk to them and kind of learn about them. What goes on? What do they care about? How do they find out about this event? Why are they here? What are their thoughts on democracy more broadly? And a lot of folks attended the No Kings protest last week, and a lot of folks were like, you know, things are really bad, but I would rather be with other people than alone when it's bad. And there seems to be, and this is a select sample, but there seems to be a growing recognition that nothing's going to change unless we do something, right? Like there's always this, like, we're waiting for someone to come and save us, and a growing recognition that, like, we are that someone.
So let's jump off. Let's jump off from there, because, and we'll, you know, we're this, let's fix this. So let's do it right now. Let's fix it right now. So let's go. Let's do this. And this is very off the cuff. Leave it in. We can fix it in post. Why don't you give me your top three? What are your top three things that have to happen?
Yeah.
In locally or even federally, what are the top three things that have to happen for us to restore American democracy?
Ooh.
Like, what does that look like?
That's a really good question. There's lots of answers to this. I'll give you my take. And I think these are mostly focused on the local level, to, like, in a state like Oklahoma that is disproportionately one party control, and there are others that are one party control the other way, we see higher levels of dissatisfaction and among voters and, like, the population, and higher levels of disengagement. Like, people feel like their vote doesn't matter, right? So it's ironic that when things get worse, people pull out rather than leaning in. The converse is true, right? In states that have more competitive elections, that have higher levels of, like, civic engagement and, like, participation, it is often in places that are generally more competitive. Now, it may still be one party control, but, like, people feel like their vote matters. I would say a few things that are big highlights for me. Open primaries.
You only get three.
Okay.
And are these in order?
No.
Okay. You got to order them, bro. That's okay. Like the whole point of the exercise.
We're doing, like, a snake draft here.
What's most important? Yeah. What's most important?
I don't have all the data I want to rank them appropriately. Let me say them all, and then maybe we can rank them together, Scott. This could be a group activity.
Okay.
I think open primaries, because it allows greater participation from a greater number, from all voters. And it, by doing so, makes elections more competitive, and you tend to elect someone who is more of a, has a broader appeal, right? Because they've got to appeal to the most voters from all parties. So that's a different message. Rather than, it incentivizes, like, broad-based support, rather than incentivizing very marginalized support to one extreme or the other. So I think open primaries is a huge deal, and I'm very excited that Oklahoma's working on it. I think money in politics has been an enormous thing for a few reasons that often don't get talked about. We all think about money in politics being gross and just, like, we don't want these corporations or wealthy people to control everything, which I agree with. It also means not just that politicians are catering to their, you know, rich donors or friends or whatever, but it, like, again, changes the incentives of how they govern. I mean, President Trump is a good example here, where he is openly, like, grifting, right? Like, taking essentially bribes, right? Like, taking money in order to do things. And so when everything, and that's part of how he governs, but when he was running, it was all about the election, right? Like, if you give me this amount of money, I'll make sure whatever happens. And there was a mechanism to allow that. And so money in politics, pulling that out, changes that. It also, and this is a contentious thought, I think, but the amount of money that floats around politics has given an outsized amount of influence to campaign consultants. Often, and they are then incentivized to campaign in a certain way, and to do things like to fill the airwaves with whatever messages and stuff. So I think there's like, it has shifted the power, for one, like away from the parties in some ways. Like, I'm not opposed to parties. I think we should have more parties. I think it should be, you know, a representative, proportionally representative system and all that, but with like multiple parties that are strong parties. But I think, I don't think we talk enough about that, right? There's this like shift that's frustrating to candidates, I know, and to a lot of voters as well. So I say that as someone who has a lot of friends who work in politics, and I know that's like a sharp blow, but I don't, it's not personal.
But I mean, also I don't know that this is true locally, but like at a national level, right? Especially for, you know, presidential campaigns, you know, I mean, probably even Senate campaigns in big states, right? Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say big states, Senate campaigns in states that are very competitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're the campaign manager, like, that's lucrative.
It is. And I think not even like campaign manager. I think of the consultant classes being a lot of other people, ad buyers, like all the people that are around the periphery whose names you never ever know.
Sure.
Who perpetuate a system that I think is bad for democracy.
Okay. So open primaries, number one for you.
Yeah.
Money followed by campaign finance reform.
Yep. And then the third one is tough. And also like not possible. Like I go back and forth. Like my inclination is to say like social media at the algorithmic base social media that we have right now, I think, creates, strengthens, and perpetuates information silos that are unhelpful to an informed and engaged electorate, or at least an informed electorate. Social media is also like a great equalizer in some ways, or it used to be. Yeah, I mean, whole ass countries were overthrown because of, like, through social media, right? Most of them have been overthrown back now, but still, like, there was the whole Arab Spring was like a real thing that happened.
Yeah, man.
Let's fix this. Was started because of social media. Like, there's
Twitter a good during side. The Arab Spring was wild.
Yes. But it's different than it was now, right? And this is that evolution where I think it's very difficult. And now it is frustrating to me, even. Like, I don't, you know, you click on the other day, I was holding my phone and almost dropped it. And as I grabbed it out of the air, like, my thumb, like, hit an ad on Instagram or something. And then for the next like 5 days, I'm getting like a bajillion ads for similar products. And I was like, man, I didn't even want that.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing where it is so profound and so deep, and like that was on one app, but those ads are across all the apps, right? Like suddenly my whole world has been shifted by an errant thumb. Okay. Well, that, if it's, you know, selling me athletic shorts, that's not a crime against democracy, but there are lots of other stuff out there.
You get a lot of ads for Viagra now.
Not as much as I used to. Yeah. Hymns. Also ads about hymns.
Yeah.
Golly. Once I turned 40, all that stuff got turned on.
I mean, I will say this. I think, I don't know that it is, I mean, you know, I don't know that it's impossible to address that. I think you could address that actually, right? I think you could start to address it, because one of the reasons that the like kind of, you know, the algorithmic siloing, that's a good term, like happens, is because all of these companies are allowed to collect, analyze, and sell immense amount of data on all of their users.
Right.
Right.
And people can say, well, just don't use them. Like, I know. But
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. But you could also
to all not use them.
Right. But the thing is, or we can either all not use them, or we can legislate how companies are allowed to collect, analyze, and sell data on their customers.
Right.
Right. Now, like the flip side of that is if TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and whatever other one, you know, is there another one? I mean, X, like, is that like, I can't believe I just called it X.
I can't either.
I can't. I just,
how dare you?
I just, and Twitter. Now, if they're not allowed to collect, analyze, and store that data, they become immensely less valuable. Right. Right, like their value goes way down. But that, I mean, that doesn't mean that that's not a thing we could do.
Right.
Right? Like that's, like, and this is where, you know, well, okay. So you said ranked choice voting, or you said open primaries, campaign finance reform, and then what do we want to call your third one? What do you want to call that? Like data regulation, or like,
yeah, it's fine. What's, yeah,
something, right? Like, right, you know, how data can be collected, analyzed, right, stored, and
I want to say sold. The reintegration of societal castes, but that's like a whole separate thing.
And maybe not castes, right. Maybe, but like, you know, but that's, I mean, because I mean, I think those are three very good ones. Now, let me see. I was listening to you and not thinking about what mine would be. Mm-hmm. Same.
No, I was going to say, there's no silver bullet, right? Like,
there's, I mean, well, I disagree. You know, Sam Seaborn would say education is a silver bullet, but.
Ah, yes.
I think, yeah, those are very good. I would say,
I mean, I was thinking of electoral stuff also. Sorry. Yeah, I know, yeah. You just got rolling there and I cut you off. If I'm like looking at societal ails, wealth inequality is a thing that drives me nuts,
yeah,
and like hurts my soul. Yeah. It is, the U.S. isn't the worst, but we're up there. I think we're 12th.
We're only 12th for, yeah, like wealth inequality. Uh-huh. That's kind of astonishing to me.
Well, there's some countries. In Chechnya, it's like one that has really poor people.
Sure.
I mean, we do too, but there's like more, right, of them or fewer. Right. I don't know.
Chechnya doesn't have a middle class.
Right. But that's a tax policy issue, right? Like, and that goes back to our earlier economic conversation.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, I think that's part of it, right? Like, I think, you know, I haven't seen, tell me this, I'm still inclined to think that ranked choice voting would be a net positive.
Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, the proportional form of it.
Yeah. So I don't know that that would, you know, I don't know that that would be, I don't know that that would be, as impactful as open primaries, but I think it would be, I think in some jurisdictions, ranked choice voting might be an easier sell than open primaries. Does the data bear that out or no?
Not enough data to tell right now. I mean, some places like California have had open primaries for more than a decade and a good track record there. Ranked choice has been used in some places for quite a long time. And it's being pretty broadly adopted at the municipal level. Like, mm-hmm, there's only a few states, Maine, Alaska, that use it right now. I expect that'll change over the next few years. It is, especially the combination of the two, right? Like the Alaska model, mm-hmm, is, I think, really something interesting to look at, where you have an open primary where everybody gets to vote, and then you have, and then the top four or five vote getters go on to the general, and then you rank them, mm-hmm, in the general election. I think that's really good. We'll see. New York City is going to use ranked choice voting again for their mayoral primary this coming Tuesday, I think. There's like, I don't know, 11 candidates in the Democratic primary and almost that many in the Republican primary, I think. Mm-hmm. And 95% of New York voters said that they liked ranked choice voting last time. And even like AOC this week or last week gave her endorsements, and she gave ranked endorsements. Like, I support this person first, this person second, this person third. You can rank the top five, which I thought was really interesting. And some people were like, wait a second, she picked more than one? It's like, yeah, because she doesn't only like one person. Like, mm-hmm, this is how it works.
Right.
I thought it was really affirming.
So I'll say RCV. I will say as well, and now listeners are going to be like, oh, God, he's been abundance-pilled. Yes, I've been abundance-pilled.
The Ezra Klein book, Abundance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Massive, massive regulatory reform, I think, is needed, right?
Is there anything less sexy to the American public?
Or to lawmakers? I mean, I think if they actually did it, I think regulatory reform could be, like, super sexy, actually,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it all of a sudden becomes easier to build things that you need, yeah, right? Like, and this is the thing, you know, I think, and this is not my analysis, this is, like, Ezra, this is not a direct quote, but it's pretty close, right? Like, what tends to happen is that progressives, you know, progressives and we'll say capital D Democrats, like, get so concerned at times with making sure that, like, how something is done, like, that it's done correctly, mm-hmm, right? And I can certainly fall into this trap, like, not just, like, politically, but, like, even, you know, in my personal life, like in the wood shop, right? I can get, yeah, so obsessed with making sure that I've done something perfectly that like I never actually get finished because I refuse to accept that it's, you know what I mean? And I'm not a good enough woodworker to get it perfect in a reasonable number of tries. But we get so obsessed with like the perfect process that it becomes impossible to actually do anything.
Right.
And you can make a compelling case that this is what has happened in California, that this is what happened in New York, like the big dig thing, right? Mm-hmm. That this is what happens in, I mean, this happens in cities that are governed by progressives all over the country, right? And it's a reason that people are fleeing those cities for places like Texas, where for all of its faults, and they have money, and even here in Oklahoma, you can come to Oklahoma and build a house. Right? Mm-hmm. You can come to Texas and build a house.
Yeah, it's hard. Right? I think it's hard for Oklahomans to think about that because we're used to it here, right? Where we have sprawling neighborhoods everywhere and it seems like anyone can build a house.
And like that,
you build it.
Right? That doesn't mean that there is not a role for like reasonable regulation that is designed to like safeguard the public, right? But you can't put so many contingencies on every project that it becomes impossible to do anything, right? Like, you know, the stat that he gives in abundance, or one of them that just blew me away, is that, and I want to say it's in 20 years, maybe, and it may not even be that long, the United States has built like 220 miles of high-speed rail or something.
Yeah.
And China has built 25,000 miles of high-speed rail. And like, these are things that we have to do if we want to compete in a global economy. So
yeah, well, because it, you know, regulatory reform would help. I think overregulation stifles innovation as well, right? Because like, you're going to do it, and you might find the easiest way to do it. Yes, but you're going to also continue to iterate and find a better way to do it.
And so, it is absolutely true that like part of the cost of housing and new construction, like some of it's inflationary and raw materials and labor and et cetera, but a huge chunk of it is also added cost from regulation and inflation that results from an undersupply of housing, right? And so, you know, when you ask Americans what, like, at a kind of more micro level, what their number one concern is, the cost of housing pulls at or near the top, and regulatory reform and massively increasing housing supply would bring down the cost. I mean, that's just economics, right? And, apparently Democrats are now the market party. So I'll say number one, ranked choice voting. Number two, a regulatory reform generally, zoning reform specifically. Number two. And then I think if we could do those things, if you could have open primaries, if you could do campaign finance, if you could do reform of how, you know, big tech is allowed to use our data, if you could do RCV, if you could do those things, then what I'm about to say next becomes possible. But in some ways, what I'm about to say next has to be the first thing for any of the rest of this to get done. Mm-hmm. Do we have a bleep still? Can we bleep things? We need, and I also we need Congress to like, we need Congress to develop some intestinal fortitude,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? We need Congress to be Congress, mm-hmm. right? I think if you have a Congress full of people that are elected in ranked choice and open primary elections, then you have a Congress that you can probably get a lot more done,
mm-hmm.
but Congress has to take back some of their authority, right? From that they have delegated to the president.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have, like, I'm a Democrat, and I support the administrative state. I think that in many ways, the administrative state is the best way to run things because, you know, Congress persons and senators cannot be experts on everything. And many of them are not experts on anything,
mm-hmm.
Except plumbing. So you need to have an administrative state that has agencies that are staffed by experts in, you know, environmental policy and trade policy and, you know, construction and all the policies, right? But we need Congress to bring back some of that. Like, they, what do they do now, right? Like, every session of Congress, they come in and they pass, in terms of meaningful legislation,
almost nothing.
Right. They pass a budget and maybe one other thing.
Yeah. I mean, the number of bills of laws passed by Congress has declined steadily over the last 20 years.
Right. It's because they're a deadlock, because they can't do anything.
And because they're not interested in governing. They're interested in winning.
Right.
Re-election.
Right. And so I'll say that is my third thing, is we need, like, you know, not congressional reform, because there's like mechanistically there's not a way to do that, but right. like we need leaders in Congress to push Congress to be Congress, right? Yeah. And like we need real budget negotiations. We need, you know, real back and forth between the White House and the Congress. Like, you know, like, mm-hmm. like, we have to get away from this. Right now, our country is being governed by essentially executive orders and then the judicial branch, mm-hmm. right? Like the courts are governing America now more than any other,
right.
more than any other branch of government.
Which because is, they're not, by and large, they're not elected, right? Right? Like they don't have the same incentives. This is what I keep talking about. I think what we should do in some other episode is discuss like, what are the things we should change? And then how do we change those? Because I think some of my three feed into your one at the end, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
how do we get a Congress that's more responsive to the people? Yeah, you have them elected in open primaries with ranked choice voting so they are accountable to more voters. Right now, in Oklahoma, as an example, we've got 5 congressional districts. They all are substantially Republican, which means that the most likely winner of all of these are the incumbents who have sit on enormous war chests because of all the money they've collected. And the only real threat they have is in the primary, right? That's like the most urgent threat. They're all Tom Cole being worried about primaries is bananas.
Yeah, it's insane. And we have been on the, this is like a whole separate question probably, but like we have for years been on the no term limits bandwagon. But like part of me has started to wonder, like,
right.
do we, I mean, like I get the political science argument mm-hmm. against term limits and it makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. because on the one hand you have someone like a Tom Cole who based on his, like, I mean, the fact that Tom is just a like sharp guy, but also like the fact that he has been in government for so long, has institutional knowledge. He mm-hmm. has actual expertise
right.
on the policy areas that he oversees,
right?
Right. He may think different, like that expertise may lead him to kind of different conclusions about those policy mm-hmm. areas than it does me. But like, no one can say, I think that Tom Cole is not an expert on like the stuff he is responsible
right.
for. Right.
Right.
And so you lose that. But at the same time, like, do you need a fresh Congress every 12 years
right.
or something?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I don't, maybe we've concluded that 12 years is too short. And we need something that's like 18 or 20 or something longer, right? Like, I remember my mom back in 2016, I think, said, was it 2016? Maybe around then. It might have been 20, Tony. But she was like, I just don't think that our founding fathers intended people to be in office for 30 years. And I was like, that does seem like a long time. Plus, that was like almost
But also, they died.
Right. I said that was their whole adulthood. But... I was like, you might be right, or they just couldn't fathom it. But such a short time frame, 12 years with two. The other thing is like 12 years of max with 2-year terms means people are always running for re-election.
I mean, is that the thing? Is the answer that you rather than term limits, I mean, does the House need to be every 4, every 6 or something? Mm-hmm. So it's not a perpetual. See, the other thing I will say, and this actually gets into campaign finance reform probably, but like, I mean, one thing that the Brits do right, you know, and one thing we do massively wrong in America is the like...
perpetual campaign season?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it needs to be like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, like, do you need everything? You've learned everything you need to know in the information age now. Like,
yeah. And the argument against it's like, well, how are not everyone's going to find out about the candidate? I was like, in today's world, they can.
Yes, they
and
will.
Also, people aren't even voting now, right? Like, most of the campaigning happens in those last 6 weeks as it is.
Right.
I mean, there are people that are announcing their congressional runs like next month, right? Okay, well, that's a year and a half out. You know, people are campaigning for governor right now. Like, that makes some sense because
you have to raise so much money.
You have to raise so much money, and they're out there like, I think it's okay to campaign. I think a prohibition on ads is the thing, right?
Yeah. Like, get rid of the ad, get rid of the, you know, like get rid of that. And I mean, just, I mean, publicly fund the campaigns.
That's other thing,
right? Like if you just publicly fund the campaigns and this all takes care of itself.
Yeah. Right. But then people feel like that's something government shouldn't be doing. I want to go back to your comment about high speed rail just real quick. Cause we talked about this on, KOSU a few weeks ago, the Heartland Flyer between Oklahoma City and Dallas or Fort Worth, right? Is going to have to shut down operations likely because the Texas state legislature refused to fund their part of it, which is only $7 million. Do you know how much the Texas state budget appropriated budget is?
I'm going to say
he's still thinking.
I'm going to say $15.2 billion.
Okay. And that's based on the fact that Oklahoma's is like $12 billion.
Is ours 12?
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm going to revise and say...
Thought you might.
Yeah. I'm going to say theirs is like $48.2 billion.
No, no. $338 billion.
Are you serious right now?
That's what it says. It's a $338 billion two-year spending plan. So maybe that's... Every 2 years. Because okay, they so do 2 year cycles, yeah.
So 160 a year then.
Yep.
My goodness.
And so.
So theirs is 10 XRs.
Yeah.
15 XRs.
And the, let's see, the Texas enacted its budget reported $144 billion in general spending and $321 billion in total spending over the 2 year period. Okay. So it's about a little over 150. That's their total. So Oklahoma's is actually bigger than our total budget is bigger than 12. The appropriated is only 12. But yeah, anyway, out of $338 billion, which to put it, to make this an easier thing, well, that's, that would be like if you had $338,000, 338,000, we can all picture that number, right? And someone said, I need $7. And you said, no. Like, that's a very tiny amount of money. That would be like if you had $338 and someone asked you for 0.7, right? So, okay, well, I can come up with that money. And Texas said no.
Does nobody write it? Like, is that the reason they don't want to? Is because
they have like 85,000 riders a year.
Okay.
And actually, the fiscal impact is really net positive. It's like a $25 million impact for Texas alone.
And also, because we have talked about connecting Oklahoma City to Tulsa, right?
So there's a proposal to not Tulsa, but go up through maybe Stillwater, but through Ponca City, and then go up to Kansas, and then on to Kansas City. And when you get to whatever that town is in Kansas, it connects to Kansas City, it connects to Chicago, it connects to Los Angeles.
Right.
So it's like a big hub. Now, it's not high speed, but it could be.
Right.
Like, we could lay tracks right next to it, maybe, right, for a high speed train. Can you imagine? I'm okay having a touristy one for those, you know, grandparents who want to take their grandkids down to Fort Worth for the day. That's fine. But to make it really useful, yeah, high speed rail connecting all of our major cities. If you could get from OKC to Dallas in even an hour and a half,
mm-hmm,
rather than 3 hours, how much easier it would be to go for the day?
Yeah.
Both places.
Yeah.
If you could get to Tulsa in 30 minutes, you know, if you, that kind of stuff like makes America closer. And I guess maybe, you know, towns in between feel left out, but the highways have already done that.
Because the thing is, because, you know, like it's 3 hours to drive, right? It's on, we fly to Dallas a lot because most of the time when we fly, we end up flying to Dallas and flying to wherever we're actually going.
Right, that's a hub, yeah.
Right, unless we're flying directly, you know, we fly from Oklahoma City direct to Chicago, we fly from here direct to California, but most of the time we end up connecting when we fly through Dallas. It is about 3 hours to get to Dallas by plane by the time you get, right? By the time you get to the airport and you board and you taxi and you take off and you land, like it takes about 3 hours. So it's not any faster to fly than it is to drive,
right.
But it would be, if you, yeah, to your point, if you could get there in an hour and a half by high-speed rail,
right
now this is the thing, like, because the Heartland Flyer actually takes a fair amount of time because it stops at two or three places in between, right? Yeah. But if you had a direct high-speed rail from Oklahoma City to Dallas and got there in an hour and a half, that would be a huge time saver over flying and driving, right?
I mean, can you imagine if you could take a high-speed rail from, like, OKC to Santa Fe or something?
Oh,
like,
man, I would use that all the time.
I would go every weekend.
Right? I mean, for real.
It would be amazing. All right, man, we probably should wrap up.
Probably.
It's been an hour of...
It's not that we can't... It's not that you and I can't sit here and jaw back and forth the rest of the day, but no one wants to listen.
No, if you're listening to us, even on, you know, 1.5x speed, you are... Well, now you're just as sad, but in three-fourths of the time, right?
But I thank you for having me back.
Of course. The door is always open.
I mean...
You have a key, literally.
I miss it. I miss it very much.
Listeners, a few stats in case people are interested, right? So we've been doing this, as we said, for 8 years now. We've had about 68,000 downloads over that time, which is insane to me. That's how many times different episodes have been downloaded. Most episodes, in case people are interested, we end up being downloaded around 400 to 600 times. You know, in the first week, it's on the 400, and then over time, people come in and listen to old episodes. We really had a big stride in like 2020 and 2021, I think because a lot was going on then. And then some of our like election reflections and those issues were the ones that were probably most interesting. I know because I've looked at it before that our most frequent guests have been Senator Julia Kurt, Minority Leader in the Senate, and State Labor Commissioner Leslie Osborne. But Scott, you and I have been here for the most episodes together. We've had many, many great guests. Bailey Wright was an excellent co-host in the right before the pandemic, through the pandemic. We've seen a lot. We've discussed a lot. I hope, my friend, that it's made you and I smarter and that it's made our listeners smarter or more informed. Before we go, though, I do think, you know, we talked about what you and I would change, and these were all big things, like what could the United States change? What do you think are... one, two, or three things that people can do here, our listeners can do to like make a positive impact on the world, on the electoral landscape, maybe?
Get five friends to vote that wouldn't otherwise every election.
Which means you have to ask your friends if they voted.
Yep.
You know, you can look them up online. You can go to badvoter.org and look up people to see if they voted. It's still active, I'm pretty sure.
But just ask, did you vote? Did you vote? And if they didn't, ask them to vote. You don't have to tell them who to vote for.
Right.
Educate them on the policy if you feel comfortable and if they want that. But you know, just say, hey, it's important. Encourage people that their voice matters, because if everyone uses theirs, it matters a lot.
Yeah. You can't look them up on Bad Voter now. Just redirects to the state election board, which you can look them up. You know their first and last name and their date of birth. You can look them up on there. But or you can call me. I can tell you if people voted. So... making sure people vote is definitely one thing. If that's uncomfortable to you.
If that is uncomfortable to you, examine why it is uncomfortable to you and ask yourself if sitting in that discomfort, engaging that discomfort, and moving past it is something that you'd be open to.
Yeah. Talk to your therapist about it. If voting is right for you. Or
it is.
I'll tell you, it costs us between $5 and $10 per person to like educate and turn out someone to vote. So if you don't want to talk to your friends, then you have to give us money so we can do it for you. And that's going to cost you $10 a pop. So give us $50. You can send us the names. We'll put them on the list. That's fine. But you should also just trust us to target the right voters. But yeah, that is an option. These are not mutually exclusive. You should ask your friends. You're much more compelling of a messenger than perhaps we are. But if you really want to supercharge this, imagine all your friends who aren't going to ask their five friends and give us money, even just $25. If people would sign up for like a $10 a month recurring donation to Let's Fix This, it would, if all of our listeners who I know subscribe to this like each week, if they would give $10 a month, which is half the price of Netflix, like we could hire two people like in the next year and really scale what we're doing. So listeners, please consider that. Many of you are donors already, and I appreciate it. If you haven't, or if you're thinking about it, you can go to letsfixthis.org/donate. You can sign up for like a $10 a month thing. I know everything's expensive and it's hard. $10 is pretty cheap. And it goes a long way. So we would be greatly appreciative. On that note, I will
Did you want two more things?
Oh, yeah, if you got them.
Yeah. So educate your friends. Donate to Let's Fix This. And if you're not comfortable asking your friends if they voted, then you probably won't do this. But, you know, you should. Volunteer for a campaign. Pick your favorite candidate. Pick your favorite candidate and volunteer for their campaign. You can knock doors if that's something that you're into, but there's a lot of stuff that you can do that's not knocking doors. There's envelopes that need to be stuffed. There's mailers that need to be sent. You can do text campaigns. You can do phone banking. I mean, there are so many ways now to get involved in the process. And when you do, you'll find out that it's fun, actually. You'll meet people, you'll make friends. Politics can be actually a really fun thing to be involved in. And then the last thing I would say, this is to piggyback that, volunteer with Let's Fix This. Because we do stuff too. We do phone banking. We do text banking, not on behalf of candidates, but
on behalf of democracy.
On behalf of democracy, right? So if that's important to you, you know, what is it that we say, Andy?
Decisions are made by those who show up.
So show up.
The clipboard out here from last night, everyone signed up and checked a box for how they want to get involved. I was like, all right, now we're talking. Specifically, listeners, we are focused on protecting the initiative petition process or reforming the initiative petition process. We had almost 100 people that attended virtual town halls over the last 2 weeks. We're going to have a bunch more. If you don't already get our emails, I say it every week, subscribe, please. That's the best way. Our podcast here, Let's Pod This. We're going to take a bit of a break for the summer. I'm going to be out of town. I know some of you are as well. And so we may still be recording in the background, but we're probably not going to publish anything for the next like 2 months. So we're going to take July and August off, and then we're going to come back in the fall with some tweaks to the system and go from there. I appreciate you. I appreciate your opportunities, your listening, your engagement. Scott, let's say it one more time.
Decisions are made by those who show up.
Have a good week, folks.